Okay, then I'm going to move us on to our next speaker. I'm seeking to unmute our next speaker. There you are, and you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Zoe Russell. I am a Black woman. I was born and raised in Dorchester. I am a student attorney at the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau and the head of the family practice area. I advocate for low-income clients in divorce, custody, and related matters. It is from this intersection of Black woman, community member, and legal professional that I categorically oppose the proposal set forth by this commission. It's hard to tell if there are many Black women in this room today. I certainly do not see any among those on the commission. And yet it has been acknowledged by several speakers that the policies this commission seeks to enact impact us the most. And so before talking about how clearly harmful and insidious these proposed changes are, let's talk about how they were not created with any input from the vulnerable communities they are supposedly meant to protect. Real care and concern for someone looks like honestly responding to their needs and desires. You've hosted this meeting to hear from us in 3-minute increments, excuse me, slightly more than 3 minutes, after you've been working on these proposed changes for over a year, and this is only after others heard what you were doing and begged you to slow down and reconsider. The proposal includes babysitters' mandatory orders. It includes increasing the fine for failure to report to $10,000. Communities like mine often utilize informal childcare where neighbors and family help watch children. The commission is asking my community to surveil and scrutinize each other with the risk of an exorbitant fine if they do not. When I was growing up, my brother and I often were responsible for ourselves, being done long before our mother came home from work. From the ages of 13 and 14, we took public transportation, ran to the store up the street for errands, and cooked for ourselves. My grandparents were always close and watched out for us. My mother relied on that. If these policies were in place when I was a child, they would turn my grandparents performing community care into police. The proposal defines reasonable cause as suspicion. Is nothing less objective, less useful, more baselessly evaluative than suspicion. When you remove an actual standard of proof, all that is left is bias, prejudice, and assumption. And with the influx of white people into my community over the course of my life, there is a lot of bias, prejudice, and assumption flying around. If I cannot trust a police officer pledged with protecting me to value my life enough to double check whether they are holding a gun or a taser, as in the case of Dante Wright, why would I ever trust a bystander turned mandatory reporter to double check whether their suspicion is warranted or racism? Members of the commission, I've heard you ask, have you seen it done better elsewhere? And I think that's an important question, but it's the question you should have started with, and you have posed it to those whose lives are most implicated by it. I implore the commission to throw away proposals and start fresh. Put the community at the forefront of this effort. Ask us, Black, Brown, Asian, LGBTQIA+, families, students, educators, religious and nonprofit leaders, what it looks like to keep our children safe and act accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the commission for our speaker? Okay, thank you very much. Okay. I'm seeking to unmute our next speaker. There you are, and you have 3 minutes to testify.
Hi, thank you. I am a parent of a first grader who has ADHD, anxiety, and social pragmatic communication disorder, which is it's a profile that's similar to Asperger's. My son, like so many other kids, has had a really hard time with remote learning. It's been a nightmare this year. He can't access learning through a screen at all. When the pandemic first started, every day was just an hours long fight trying to figure out anything to get him to engage with any part of his schoolwork. And unfortunately, I think we really damaged our relationship with our son by trying to force him to do something that we and he knew that he couldn't do. When he first restarted in-person learning, which was back in September. It went well when he was actually in the classroom. But it was hard to get him to go there because his routine had been so disrupted for so long. These kind of kids, they really thrive on a routine. His schedule at first was Thursdays and Friday mornings and every other Wednesday mornings. And that was really confusing to him. And he would always ask on Wednesday, is it an in-school day or is it an online day? And we have been working with an at-home ABA therapist and had a visual schedule, but it didn't seem to help very much. He didn't understand why everything was so confusing. And then in, I think it was October, the school agreed to let him do remote learning in the building on Thursday and Friday afternoons so that he could at least access some of the remote learning, but it didn't really help. And because he had missed so much school and he had been unable to access remote learning, he was really behind some of his classmates who had at least been able to do some of that. Then maybe it was in early January, after his IEP meeting, they agreed to add an additional Monday and Tuesday afternoons, but this time it was one-on-one with a paraprofessional in a small office. And that is when he started refusing to go to school. He's very social and he really needs to be in a classroom, like with a teacher, to have the ability to stay motivated and engage in the schoolwork. And my husband and I additionally have been doing parent training with the BCBA that the school provided at least 1 hour every week all year. And we talk to the school every day to tell them if he's able to come or not. So the school told us to call them 15 minutes after he refuses to go to school. That 15 minute thing is really hard too, because it's not just like my son says, I won't go to school and then we're done. It's an hours long process of negotiation and trying to ease his anxiety to get him to go. And I can't really stop in the middle to call the school, or I risk losing the momentum that I've gained with him in that negotiation. So sometimes I'm not able to call the school until, you know, 9:30 or 10 in the morning.
So you are out of time. So if you want to take a couple of sentences to wrap up.
Okay. So about a month ago, my husband got a voicemail saying that DCF was calling to tell us about the report. And it was just really anxiety provoking and hurtful, because my son, I mean, it said that educational neglect of the son by the mother, the child missed a certain number of days, 9 full and 5 half, and the family has not been able to follow through with any plan. But I felt like we had been working so hard all the time to get my son to be able to go to school because of his disabilities. And now I just feel like, who can we trust at the school, you know? So it's hard to work with people that you feel like were on your side, but then went behind your back and made a phone call instead of telling you that they felt like you weren't doing a good job. There was no collaboration there, and that was upsetting.
Thank you. Any commission members
This is Maria Masaitis, the child advocate for the Commonwealth. I would really appreciate it if you would call our hotline and give us the information about which school system it was, because this is exactly the kind of case that the Office of the Child Advocate intervenes on. We don't intervene on 51As, but the sort of, it's very important where you've been in a circumstance where the school system has not apparently collaborated with you to bring that to our attention. So let me suggest that you call our hotline number, and that's 617-979-8360. And I would really appreciate it if you gave us a call. Your name will be kept confidential while we look into that matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. thank you all. And I did just put some information about the OCA line in the chat, so everyone should be able to see that. Do we have any other questions or comments for our speaker?
Hi, this is from CPCS. I just want to thank everybody here who has taken the time to give their personal stories to help us work on this issue. I also want to address the concept that this recommendation is final. The recommendation is not final. No one here has voted on anything, and there needed to be some sort of language for people to react to. But in the same token, I certainly have very strong views against many of the recommendations, and I'll be working on that to work with our other commission members to talk to them about it. And after this testimony is put in, all this fantastic testimony from both the affected communities and from professionals who work in this space. So thank you once again. And I just want everyone to understand that this is a process, and we are now, we met as a group of people who were appointed and appointed by the statute and talked about, you know, what we knew and our perceptions of what was going on. And now we're reaching out to the affected community to try to get real information on the ground, affected community information. So thank you all, especially for taking your time on a Saturday to come and talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I do want to echo what Lisa says, that the commission is putting together a report to submit to the legislature as our statute requires. So that is the work that the commission is working on right now. The proposals in the document for public comment are proposals presented to the commission members for their consideration. I do want to note that the written public comment period remains open and it'll be open till April 21st. So if anyone is interested in submitting written comments, if you haven't done so already, or supplementing what you've said here today with written comments, you can do so via the written comment period, which is open until April 21st. All right, I will note again for anyone who has joined the meeting that if you are interested in testifying, please write your name in the chat to me, the host of the meeting, and I will put you on the list. If you are participating by phone and would like to testify, you can text the number 781-870-0432. 781-870-0432. If you have already chatted your name, there is no reason to text the phone number. I've already got you on the list. And I will move on to our next participant, who I will seek to unmute right now. There you are, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Palma McLaughlin. I am the Children and Family Specialist with the League of Women Voters of Massachusetts, which represents 47 leagues across the Commonwealth. Since its inception 100 years ago, one of our first platforms was supporting evidence-based child welfare programs. And with this in mind, we'd like you to consider the negative consequences and impact of the proposed revisions. Due to bureaucracy, legislative mandates, time constraints, attribution errors, confirmation biases, assessments, and often inaccurate and biased information, the information given in a 51A is frequently given more weight than the input from the parent or less available exculpatory information. Have you lost me?
No, we haven't lost you, but I'm going to ask that you slow down. We do have interpreters on the line interpreting, and just for anyone who's joined, Spanish, Portuguese, and Haitian Creole, and they're going to have trouble keeping up with you, I can tell already. So
please. I apologize. There is written testimony being submitted. I would actually like to point out that in 2015, a U.S. Department of Justice, U.S. Health and Human Services report actually found that DCF was using gut feelings and vibes to substantiate investigations. And there is an ongoing tendency to pathologize problems. There is an ongoing tendency for social workers to become police officers. Even mandated reporters become police officers, using that to coerce compliance with their idea of how a child should be raised. The intrusion into a family's life can have a powerful negative effect. parents and children experience intense feelings of fear, anger, shame, which is exacerbated by the lack of transparency. I'm sorry, I'm trying to slow down. In fact, the residual anxiety reported in children means that after it's left, they have nightmares of being kidnapped, and they describe their own experience as Kafkaesque, disconnected, and inhumane. A social scientist from the UK explained her feelings because she was actually reported, had an investigation done because she had a child that was disabled. And 5 years later, she was still experiencing post-traumatic stress syndrome related to the investigation and unsubstantiation of a report. Mandated themselves, frankly, as we stand now, mandated reporters are unsubstantiated 84% of the time, with the exception of medical personnel, which means the mandated reporters we have now aren't doing a good job. In fact, there is little evidence that mandated reporting is beneficial, but there is more evidence that increased reporting by non-professional does harm to children, families, parents, the child, and the system itself. It places enormous pressure on limited resources, with the agency diverting from endangered children to investigate. One of the things that happens with extended reporting is that people tend to report rather than help. In other words, somebody who might help someone, maybe connect with a job or connect with a food pantry, will report instead. Non-professionals frequently report families for things like inadequate housing, financial problems, or even letting kids play alone in the park. There is a cultural competency that is required when dealing with families who are continually dealing with not enough resources and having to make choose between bad choices. It is a cultural competency that cuts across race and immigration status, but complicates the matters. There is
you
also
are out of time, so please take a few sentences to wrap up.
All right. I would also like to echo the risk to vulnerable populations, such as domestic violence and disabled parents. I would like to say the training, as I've seen it, is inadequate to begin with. Expanding it, putting it online will not help. How many of us have gone to get a cup of coffee while we're waiting? And finally, I would actually like to address a question, something that's been brought up a couple of times that's not in my testimony. I do have one example of where it works better. Several years ago, I was speaking with the principal of a large inner city school who had gotten a grant to hire a social worker specifically to deal with these issues. In the year that they had the number of reports made dropped from between 80 and 100 to 3. And of those 3, 2 of them were made in collaboration with the parent, the caregiving parent. In other words, a 97% drop in filing, but more people were getting help and more people were trusting the system. Right now, people do not. All right, thank you very much. I will submit written testimony.
Thank you, appreciate that. Do any commission members have any questions for our last speaker? Okay, thank you. Give me one moment. I'm unmuting our next participant.
Hello.
There you are. Okay, go ahead. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I am a single mother of 2 children in the Western Mass public school system, with children who are in the Western Mass public school system. I am also an inpatient care provider for women and infants at a local hospital. My children and I have been suffering from PTSD and sleep disturbances due to a traumatic event that included fatalities. I had been requesting accommodations with the recommendations of his pediatrician to support my son's social emotional needs, such as not being required to keep his camera on, as this heightened his symptoms of PTSD and anxiety during remote learning. Instead of finding ways to support him, his teacher would threaten him that if he did not turn on his camera, he would be marked absent or receive a zero while he was taking a test or a quiz. I was recently contacted by the school nurse while we were home ill with COVID. I had asked why they were calling me asking our symptoms when we were already under the care of a physician. Their reply was that they could put accommodations in place, such as limited screen time, excused absences, and allowing for their camera to be off. I informed the nurse that I had already requested these accommodations via a 504 plan due to my son's disabilities and was informed that these accommodations could not be granted through remote learning. She said she thought it was odd considering other children were already receiving these accommodations. I then expressed my frustrations that I felt the 504 team was not fulfilling their need or their responsibilities and how I felt they were neglecting my children's needs and ignoring their disabilities. I stated that I would be reaching out to the principal again after already having communicated with her and the teacher regarding these issues, and instead of having resolution, they seemed to push them off. I informed the nurse that I was ill with COVID and I was exhausted as being ill with COVID, and she recommended that I focus on getting better and not to worry about anything. Before we were recovered, I was being contacted by DCF due to the school reporting me for neglect via 51A. I feel that the school system abused their power by, instead of resolving matters or supporting my children's mental health needs and disabilities, they retaliated by calling in a 51A due to my complaints. I just want to point out that this has caused more stress and has increased my children's symptoms of PTSD and anxiety, and that I have been trying everything in my power to help my children, and it's very discouraging getting reported for neglect when I have been doing everything to help my children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any commission members who would like to ask any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. I am seeking to unmute our next presenter. There you are, you're unmuted. If you.
Hi, I'm Roxanne. I'm a Black social worker that's worked for DCF for 18 years as a domestic violence specialist. I provided leadership to create a DCF-sponsored brochure titled Promising Approaches, Working with Families, Child Welfare, and Domestic Violence. This was an 8-year project with a multidisciplinary effort with our community partners, DCF leadership, and the Domestic Violence Unit. The purpose of this brochure was to provide a framework for mandated reporters to use family-centered assessments in order to file reports as appropriate after understanding the impact of intimate partner violence. And also to gain an understanding of the complications on a family's life, and that our current mandated reporters to understand those dynamics as they work to fulfill an obligation to keep families safe. Finally, this brochure was meant to exercise best practice as a mandated reporter within the context of their clinical judgment. Being a paid professional and having an obligation to perform this task offers a check and balance regarding ethical decisions. The commission's proposal to extend a mandated reporter list would not have any check or balance, only to minimize a family's experience to an automatic filing in the context of when in doubt, which utilizes that individual's cultural lens, which has the biggest impact on marginalized Black, Brown communities primarily. The assessing of domestic violence concerns is a specialized, nuanced practice that is supported with supervision, oversight, and for me, NASW ethical value system. This proposal serves to minimize the roles of the social work profession and our other mental health focused colleagues. We have learned from research that when a family is provided support, empathic listening, validation, acknowledgement, that they are able to keep their children safe. Filing a 51A cannot be deemed as a supportive effort. This proposal can and will increase danger in a domestic violence situation for children and families. I want to give one example as I work with CPCS as a freelance social worker. This family, where DCF is saying the children cannot be reunified because they simply do not believe that the parent has made observable measures of change behavior in the context of domestic violence. In my mind, I have to wonder, what's going to happen with this proposal to extend mandated reporter lists, as I know training is not enough. DCF staff, in my experience, have had training regarding domestic violence, child maltreatment, and many other topics. And yet, I'm working currently with a case and a family and a DCF office that is making decisions based on an individual, personal worldview perspective, not on the work, the merits that this parent has achieved in a terrible situation where this parent has been victimized. I am opposing because it will cause increased. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any commission members who have any questions for that last speaker?
Yes, this is Lisa Hewitt. What I'm taking from your testimony is that you think that the emphasis is in the wrong place, that the emphasis of government appears to be just identifying as opposed to putting the needed services in place. Am I understanding you correctly, or could you talk a little bit about that?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, what I hear you saying is that I am talking about the damage done by government, the damage done by society, and not understanding the victimization or the re-victimization, and how we need to work towards an effort to continue in other efforts to support families to make the changes, sustainable changes for their children to keep them safe. And that filing, we know, and DCF involvement does not always create what we think it creates, which is safety for children in every situation. We need people who understand how to assess and understand the complexity that happens in domestic violence situations, intimate partner violence, to be more specific. I hope I'm answering your question.
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have any other commission members who would like to ask a question? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I just want to note that one of the people who identified themselves via the chat as the name Sue, I can no longer find in my list. So if you've since changed your name, please message me to get back on the list with a different name. In the meantime, I'm going to unmute our next presenter.
Thank you.
Here you are, you're muted. Great, 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name's Diane and I live in Massachusetts. I'm the mother of an autistic 5-year-old. When I was 18 and a senior in high school, I hit black ice at 20 miles an hour and shattered half my skull, resulting in a traumatic brain injury, depression, anxiety, and epilepsy. I have worked for years with a medical team of over 6 doctors and specialists, as well as my daughter's medical team, including daily in-home ABA therapy, which is a form of autism therapy, to make sure that my disabilities are effectively controlled and that my daughter feels safe and comfortable if ever I do have a seizure, since that is now my life. This includes a daily seizure plan that we do practice. Now in 2018, when we had first initialized the seizure plan, my daughter was very excited, went to school, was talking about this, which initiated a 51A for quote unquote supposed neglect of me having a quote unquote seizure, which I did not have. DCF stepped into my home and forced me to get a neuropsych evaluation, on which I did score within the normal range for adults my age. And they forced me to place my daughter in the Head Start program as added support. And then they did close that case. After we did, again, my daughter became four and we changed her learning process with age. She became excited again about the new seizure video we had initiated. She went to school and stated, "Mom had a 30-hour seizure. Did you know Mom has epilepsy?" Which prompted Head Start to file another 51A on me for having a quote unquote 30-hour seizure, which is medically impossible. And DCF stepped into my home again. They called me, they called my doctor. My doctor stated it was impossible for me to have a seizure. And DCF kept this open and went all the way to a supervisor who told me when I asked, "What is the form of neglect?" "Well, it is noted here that you have a quote unquote chronic brain injury and seizure disorder." And the fact that DCF just completely disregarded not only the impossible, but medical doctors and my medical team, there really aren't words for what's going on currently with mandated reporting. To good, just open it up for even more of this for the 1/4 of Americans that are disabled, the 1/6 of Americans with epilepsy, and the 9 out of 10, according to the Americans Associations with Neurologists, who will have a seizure in their lifetime, is shocking. And I hope you take anything that I said to heart, because I'm shocked.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from our commission members for that speaker? Thank you for your testimony. Okay, now I'm going to unmute someone who's on the phone. The last 4 digits are 8876. I don't know if you'll see that you're unmuted. There you are.
Hi. One second. Good afternoon. I'm a single working mother of 3 children, 2 sons and a daughter. One of my sons has 4 step siblings, and I also raised them all. All of the older children are grown, and they're doing very well. Most of them have families now and children of their own. I also help raise all of my nephews and most of the boys on my son's wrestling team. My house is a place where young people come, where they have no place else to go. When they grow up, they come back, they thank me for giving them a place. My 14-year-old daughter is still lives at home with me in Springfield. She is deaf. She also has ADHD and ODD. I have done everything for her. I have gotten her therapy, psychiatrists, mentors, behavioral support. I have taken her all the way to Boston multiple times to have experts evaluate her. I've been to every single IEP meeting. I am taking sign language classes to help me communicate with her. I've done everything I can do to help her move forward in life. But her care is consistent, and it has not been easy for a single parent who works. Since she was little, she's attended the school for the deaf. Even though she attends a special school, her life at school has been just like at home, very challenging and hard to deal with. She's been aggressive towards peers, adults. She has many tantrums and refusals. At first, I tried to trust the school's knowledge because I thought they dealt with students like her, but I learned they were not actually capable of supporting her. The school did not have the therapeutic expertise she needed. It was very challenging for them, and they became very frustrated. My daughter also became more frustrated because she was not getting her needs met. She became more and more defiant at school. And this is when the DCF call started. It started with me disciplining my daughter for something that she should have not done. She went to the school and told them. After talking to the school and explaining the situation to them, here comes DCF. They went to school and met with my daughter before even contacting me. She was so scared because I wasn't there to help explain it to her. She's deaf, and that makes the communication hard. She didn't understand what was going on. Then they came to the house. They went all through my house and asked me all these questions. They were so intimidating to me, asking the same questions over and over again. All you can do is sit there scared because you don't know what to do. All you can think of is, are you going to take my child? With her being deaf and special needs, how would she communicate? Who would take care of my child, if not me? After putting me through this, the report was unsupported, but the school kept calling DCF at least 4 or 5 more times. It doesn't matter how many times I've been through this. The same fear starts over and over again. It starts with looking out your window, waiting for them to come. Part of me always expects the police to show up with them. Everyone in the house is uptight and afraid. We take it out on each other because we are scared. So we know we haven't done anything wrong, but you don't know what might trigger them to take your child out of your home. Who are they going to believe? That word neglect is so broad, you just don't know where DCF is coming from. This creates stress. It's terrible. On top of this, there is everything this takes out of your time-wise, money-wise, emotionally. You have to miss work. A lot of times your employer doesn't give you the sick time or vacation. I had to run back and forth. I'm a few more seconds, I'm almost done. I had to run back and forth from my job to home to meet DCF multiple times. They didn't even show up. I don't know DCF. I know DCF should not have been called. My daughter is clearly not abused. She's up to date on everything. I have all these professionals involved in her life. She's not hidden. All of them are mandate reporters. Everyone knows she's not abused. The school knows this too, and yet they still call DCF. It doesn't make any sense to put this under a bigger umbrella with you making families who do not abuse and neglect their children go through all of this. You would disrupt all these people's lives. Please don't expand mandating reporting in the way you are considering. If you do so, it would hurt many families, children, family and children. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Does any commission member have any questions for our speaker? Yeah, thank you very much. All right, I want to remind everyone who's interested in testifying to please submit your name to me, the host, via the chat function. If you are participating via phone, you can text the number 781-870-0432. Again, 781-870-0432. And I want to remind everyone to please speak slowly for our interpreters. I'm going to unmute our next speaker. There you are, you have 3 minutes.
Okay. My name is Carla Kearns, and I'm the mother of a 7-year-old boy with autism who's legally blind and has struggled with virtual learning this year. Because virtual school has been conducted entirely by Microsoft Teams, which he cannot access because he cannot see the screen sharing, we've had to hire full-time babysitters to assist him with virtual school in order to wrestle out of here with virtual school.
No.
In order to read the screen to him and help him pay attention and focus while his peers are looking at what they can see on the screen. I raised concerns about this not being appropriate for him due to his legal blindness in the second week of school, but it took 4 more IEP meetings before he was finally placed at the state school for the blind for the remainder of the school year. Keeping an autistic, legally blind 7-year-old engaged in inappropriate virtual school he cannot see for 5 hours a day was a difficult job. We went through 3 experienced nannies in the fall before we finally found a certified teacher who was able to do it. She had to leave in January due to a medical crisis of her own, and we hired a replacement who'd been a nanny for more than a decade. I explained about our son's disabilities and how we support them. He has therapy every day after school, ABA, DIR, OT, speech, and music. He's relatively high functioning, and his main autism challenges are in social communication, sensory processing, and poor interoception. He is a generally happy kid and one who was only diagnosed recently because he is very verbal and appears typical in many ways. But his textbook autism symptoms include resistance to bad.
I ask you to please slow down because the interpreters can't keep up with you.
I'm sorry. His textbook autism symptoms include resistance to baths, having his hair brushed, and brushing his teeth. He's also been slow to potty train, which is, again, a textbook feature of autism. We worked on this since he was two with his pediatricians, occupational therapists, ABA therapists, and multiple multidisciplinary clinics focused on potty training. We've seen everyone. In the past 3 years, he's slowly become independent in using the bathroom, but he continues to have occasional accidents. These are usually related to his failure to recognize that he has to go, or failure to go early enough. Again, he has interoception as a diagnosed disability. He's reliably able to go now, but sometimes needs help getting cleaned up. The new babysitter was horrified by this. She appeared to accept my explanation initially, but she became frustrated with him easily. At the end of her second week working with him, she no-showed by text message at 7 a.m. And at 4, I received a call from a CPS investigator who indicated that she was at my house. I was in the car with my son returning from therapy at the time, and while I drove home, my thoughts raced and I tried to guess what this might be about. The first thing I thought of was that it was his teacher of the blind, because the conflict over his inappropriate special education plan, virtual school he cannot see, was still ongoing. When we got home, the CPS caseworker indicated that she'd received a call about neglect because of his difficulties brushing his teeth and potty training. She also expressed concerns about the fact that he sometimes sleeps with me because he's been having nightmares after losing two grandfathers in the face of the pandemic. I explained all of this and that the complaints were all due to his known disabilities. But the caseworker was still confused. Parents of disabilities come under scrutiny in a number of ways. And our experience is common with a caseworker who'd been on the job for less than a month, she told me, with no experience in disabilities or autism in particular, failing to recognize that the call that she received about neglect was actually the manifestations of his disabilities.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you are out of time. So if you want to take a couple sentences to wrap up.
Sure. Observers may misinterpret the manifestations of disability as bad parenting. And if we're going to expand mandated reporters, then these families are likely to face more and more reports. I would ask the commission to consider training in disabilities for their investigators, if nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any commission members who have questions for that past speaker? Okay, thank you for your testimony. So at this point, we have 15 minutes left in our time block here. I do not have anyone else currently in my list to testify. So if anyone who has not testified yet is interested in testifying, please chat me via the chat function as the host right now. Or if you are participating by phone and would like to testify, your number is 781-870-0432. Again, 781-870-0432. And I'd like to remind everyone that there is a opportunity to provide written testimony to the commission via the public comment written period, which is open until April 21st. Information about that is on the Mandated Reporter website, which I'll pop into the chat prior to ending this meeting. I do have one person who would like to testify who did testify at the previous meeting, since we do have available time, I'll offer him 3 minutes. And
Chrissy, before you promote that person, may I suggest that many of you, if not all of you, who have testified today and have your comments in writing, please submit them as written comments, because you know, we've all tried to be at both of these hearings, and sometimes some of our members couldn't make it. And I would want all our commission members to hear all of this testimony, especially for those who told us about, you know, what they have experienced in the system, you know, and the type of impact it's had on their families. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate you noting that, yes. And I will put a link to the Mandate Reporter website in the chat in just one moment. Okay,
thank you very much for letting me come back. I wanted to follow up on some of the comments that Professor Levy made. He made some very wise comments about what people should think about when they're trained and how to train them, but there's a problem. Many of his comments also appeared in a column he wrote for a trade journal. In that column, he said, I quoted H.L. Mencken, who said, no matter what the problem is, there's always a solution that is clear, simple, and wrong. But he left out the child welfare corollary to that. In child welfare, the solution that is always given and that is clear, simple, and wrong is more training. No matter what the problem, it's always said, if we just have more training, that's going to fix it. It doesn't. Training is no substitute for due process of law. And I ask the commission to consider this. Imagine if a special commission were convened to study police brutality in Massachusetts. Imagine if they said all the problems could be solved if we just gave the police more training. Imagine if they claimed the problem isn't, say, massive use of stop and frisk policing. They said, we just need to give the police more training in whom to stop and how to frisk. I don't think anybody would believe that, certainly not anymore. And it's the same in child welfare. Even if people were to understand the new improved training that Professor Levy suggests, they still would fear that if they follow the training, they face a fine. And this commission has proposed raising it to up to $10,000. There's also a peculiar double standard concerning training. In many cases, mandated reporters have vastly more training than DCF caseworkers. When a parent has a substance use issue, why are well-trained medical professionals denied this opportunity to use their training and their professional judgment concerning whether the substance use is endangering a child and whether DCF intervention would help or hurt? Instead, they are forced to turn that judgment over to caseworkers who may be far less trained. Two other quick points. First, I wonder when the tapes of these hearings will be released so the public can hear them. And secondly, the question about the dread, the point was raised that these are only draft recommendations, that it's all preliminary and so on. Granted, but why is it that almost every single one of these preliminary, not voted on draft recommendations proposes making the system bigger, more coercive, and more intrusive? Why aren't there an equal set of draft, preliminary, not voted on recommendations that call for dialing it back, for providing more help instead of more surveillance, for providing better alternatives, or even abolishing mandatory reporting? Thank you. And to the people who have worked the hardest today, the translators, merci, gracias, obrigado.
Do any of our commission members have any questions for this last speaker? Please feel free to unmute yourselves. Okay. Thank you very much. In response to the question about posting the recording, I'm unfortunately going to have to not answer that, as we have technical issues where I will have to That'll have to be decided at a later date. So I'm sorry, I can't provide an answer right now to that. All of our materials are available at the Band-Aid Reporter Commission webpage, which I put in the chat to everyone. I do have one more person indicating that they'd like to speak. So I will unmute them in one moment. But I want to indicate that even though it may take us some time to post materials, materials will be posted on the Band-Aid Reporter website. And materials are currently there about this commission, about the public comment period, and I put those links in the chat. Okay, I'm going to unmute our next speaker. There you go, and you have 3 minutes.
I'm a clinical social worker in Massachusetts, a relatively new white social worker. Wasn't planning to speak today, but I've been deeply grateful for everyone who has shared all of their testimony. And I wonder if I can ask the commission, we've heard today that these proposed expansions will be pretty devastating to our Massachusetts communities. They'll exacerbate the embedded ableism and racism in our reporting systems. And I wonder if anybody can kind of acknowledge that what we've heard today will be taken seriously and that we will proposed. Thank you.
So thank you. So I can assure you that the Mandated Reporter Commission, since its inception, decided that they wanted to gather public feedback. That's been the discussion since the commission was created, including in the working group prior to the commission, was interested in collecting public feedback. That's why we have two public hearings and we do have the written comment period. It is our intention to have all that feedback discussed at commission meetings, which will happen in the next few months, and will inform commission members, I'm sure, their positions and the information presented to the commission, which will ultimately inform the report that is submitted to the legislature. Does any commission member have any questions for our last speaker?
I don't, but I'll just say, just speaking as one commission member, you know, and I can't speak for others, but I can only assume it's similar, that we will absolutely be taking all of this testimony to heart and quite seriously, and in particular for the reasons that many folks raised, that we acknowledged an absence of certain perspectives and wanted to be sure to the best of our ability that we could get those. And so for what it's worth, from one commission member here, you have my word that for everyone who spoke today, we will be taking this quite seriously. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. I have, hold on one moment for me. Okay, I have one, person who has testified anonymously who is asking for 30 more seconds to testify to complete their testimony, which I will provide them, and that will be our last testimony for today. So I'm going to close to keep you to your 30 seconds there, unmute you. There you go.
Thank you. I just wanted to add quickly that when DCF does open a case in regards to neglect, how it impacts a family, not only, you know, at any level, of course it can affect a family, but as a medical professional who works with infants and children, going forward, obviously this would negatively reflect my reputation as a professional, which in turn would make it more difficult for me to potentially get a job in the future, which would increase further issues economically and with things that I already struggle with as a single mother, and my children not being of a white population. So there's a lot of demographics that play into effect with that as well. And not to mention how it just adds additional stress that is keeping me from providing medical care and needs to the general population as well, because I am not getting support in those other areas that are needing support with the school setting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And do we have any further questions or comments from the commission? We're right at 3:27 here, so we're going to end on time, but I'm going to give any opportunity for the commission to say, commission members to say anything in closing.
Let me just add a thank you, a big thank you to our interpreters who have done an amazing amount of work over our two sessions. I want to thank the commission members who were able to join us today, as well as for individuals who have come forward to share their experiences. I certainly encourage individuals, the Office of the Child Advocate is the official state ombudsman for all children's services across the Commonwealth. We do operate a confidential complaint line, and we encourage individuals to bring forward their concerns. We work closely with all of the human service agencies, as well as the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, and your concerns will be addressed. It is very helpful for us to get those concerns because it enables us to track patterns, both at an individual municipal level and individual DCF office level, if the concerns are around practice issues at DCF. And that information is shared not only with the Secretary of Education and Secretary of Health and Human Services, but with key members of the legislature. So we deeply appreciate the collaboration of our state agency partners, but more importantly, it is critical for us to hear from individual families about their experience so that we can continue to undertake efforts to make the systems as family friendly as possible. So thank you all for being here today, and we will be adjourning this hearing at this moment.
Thank you.